Welcome to the Pin Down, your Detroit Pistons podcast. I'm your host, Wes Davenport from Motor City Hoops and Detroit Bad Boys.
And I'm Blake Silverman, writer for Detroit Bad Boys, covering everything from the Pistons to the NBA draft and the Motor City Cruise.
And all right, guys, so we are recording immediately after the Pistons 121-113 loss to the Atlanta Hawks. If you guys are tuning in live with us either on YouTube or Twitter, thank you so much. We appreciate you guys. Make sure you do go ahead and like and subscribe. We're not good about saying that on the YouTube page. So please, please do like and subscribe on the YouTube page. It does help us out a lot. And on the podcast platforms, if you want, leave a comment. We do sometimes watch those. So, you know, we appreciate all the interaction in that way. But, you know, I feel bad because I said this was the Pistons 121-113 loss to the Atlanta Hawks, when really this was Malachi Flynn's 121-113 loss to the Atlanta Hawks. Was it not? What a game.
Wild. 50 points, 5 threes, 6 rebounds on top of that, and 5 assists, 4 steals. Like, what got into that man? Like, it's the he did it off the bench too, and they mentioned on the broadcast it's only the third bench 50 point game of all time. Most points a Piston has scored off the bench. So I wasn't expecting it, but I'm happy to see it for him. It made the game super fun. I was happy to see the team get pumped for him on the bench. It just made a game that I went into like kind of not very excited to watch. It ended up being very exciting because of Malachi Flynn.
Oh, yeah. It did become pretty incredible to just watch that point total keep going. I mean, I think at halftime he might have been on pace for 40, and then obviously he exceeded that when even 40 at the time felt like, you know, ooh, pump the brakes a little bit. But all right, let's just open it up here. This is my claim, Blake. This is my claim. This was the most improbable 50 point game in NBA history. So I want to read some things off to you, and here are the numbers. Jamal Crawford, 14.6 points per game for his career. Nick Anderson, 14.4 points per game for his career. Malachi Flynn, 5.2 points per game for his career. Why am I lumping these three guys together? Because they are the only three players in NBA history, per the broadcast, to score 50 points off the bench. That's it. He's averaging 9 less points per game for his career. And he just scored 50. That's insane.
That is insane. And before we jumped on, I asked you what was more improbable, this or Sadiq Bey's 50-point game a few years ago. And, like, Malachi Flynn was clearly the answer. I was just looking back to that because sometimes you see on Twitter people are like, remember when Sadiq Bey dropped 50 points? But you're right. It's the most – I mean, I don't remember the Jamal Crawford or – Nick Anderson 50-point games off the bench. But what stuck out about Malachi Flynn's performance to me is in the like pretty late in the fourth quarter, he was only like 3 for 4 from three. Like, he was pushing 40 or at 40 when he only made 3 threes. I mean, he got to the line 12 times, made 9 of them, so that helped. But it, like, a lot of times I feel like when you see, I don't want to say random, but a player that you're not expecting to go off, it's because they make like 5 threes in the first quarter or something crazy like that. And that wasn't really the case for Malachi Flynn. He dropped 50 points on 25 shots off the bench, which is absolutely crazy.
In only 34 minutes, Blake. 34 minutes. That's it.
It's nuts.
That's peanuts.
And we're definitely overreacting, but I did see a few people say this, like, did he play his way into sticking around next year? Like, could something like this do that? I don't think that's the case, but it is interesting. If he is trying to stick around, like, what better way to do it than this?
Look, I'll just say this. Don't let any thoughts about the future or his contract situation spoil what was an incredible night of basketball for Malachi Flynn. Like, this was so improbable. It came out of the blue. He probably wasn't even expecting to play against the Hawks because Cade Cunningham was a late scratch and Marcus Sasser was healthy. So he was entrenched in that PG3 role right there until about, you know, 20 minutes before tip off, where he's going to learn that, hey, Cade's not going tonight. So like, just let's just live in the moment for a little bit. And then, you know, then we can talk about some more of the Pistons stuff. And yeah, I just wanted to continue giving him his flowers, because in a game where, again, they lose by 8, Malachi Flynn not only scores 50, but he does it with extreme efficiency. You mentioned he only shot 25 shots to the free throw line 12 times. He was 5 of 9 from 3, but he also had 6 rebounds, 5 assists, 4 turnovers, which isn't great, but when he had the ball as much as he did, pretty good. And on top of that, he balanced out the 4 turnovers with 4 steals. Like, he was everywhere. He really was. It was a complete game, not just a 50-point game. It was a complete game.
Yeah, you're right. And towards the end, when I think he was at 48, he made just like the right pass and picked up an assist when he could have been selfish and went for it there. I thought it was so awesome that little like layup where he got the ball back and he was at 48 and he missed it, but you could see the bench about to go absolutely nuts. And then the Pistons end up stealing the ball from the Hawks, and he gets 50 shortly after, and they went crazy anyway. But stuff like that is just fun to see, especially when we're already in April and these games don't matter at all for the Pistons. Like, it makes it so fun. So happy for him. I mean, it's fun for the entire group as well. Like we said, we're recording immediately after the game, so I'm excited to see like what Monty Williams had to say, what Malachi Flynn had to say, and whoever else of his teammates had post-game media availability today. So just an awesome moment in a horrible stretch of basketball for the team.
Well, and hey, how about this of just like interesting footnotes, I guess, that came out of this game before we dive into some other things outside of, you know, Malachi Flynn and the fun around that. But the Pistons played 9 guys, just 9. So they didn't run a 10-man rotation. There was no full all-bench lineup. And on top of that, and this, you know, goes without saying, because one of my favorite phrases is friends don't let friends use single game plus minus. I'm going to break my own rule. All 4 of those bench players have positive plus minuses, where all 5 of the starters have negative plus minuses, which it does kind of track with how things looked on the court, which is the only reason I bring it up. But that's interesting.
Well, thank you, Malachi Flynn, for that as well. Not the only reason, but definitely a big reason. But yeah, I mean, how are you not going to absolutely just crush the other team in bench points when you have a guy drop 50 off the bench? But yeah, the bench unit looked good. The starters didn't really do much. I mean, Sasser is the only one other than Malachi Flynn to make more than 1 3 tonight, and he didn't do that efficiently at all. He was 4 for 13 from the field, 3 for 8 from 3. Not horrible, but when the rest of the starters can't really find it scoring wise, it just hurt. Like, you didn't really have anyone.
All right, let's talk about, I mean, there were quite a few negatives, and I'm willingly letting the Malachi Flynn fun kind of overshadow that. But before we get into questions, we would be remiss not to bring up 2 guys that we've talked, you know, at length about here over the past few weeks on this podcast, and that would be Jalen Duren and Jaden Ivey. So Jalen Duren, Jaden Ivey, they played 28 and 27 minutes respectively. Jalen Duren had 11 points, 4 rebounds, and 2 steals, no blocks though, and shot 5 of 13 from the floor, only got to the free throw line once. Jaden Ivey, 3 of 15 from the floor. As you mentioned, he was only 1 of 4 from 3, only got to the line twice, scored only 8 points, had 1 turnover, 4 assists, 3 rebounds. Not the banner night from those 2 guys that you might have hoped to see with Cade Cunningham being a late scratch. What do you make out of the game that we saw from those 2 against the Hawks?
It was interesting because when the game started, I was actually about to text you and say, oh, so we're getting a Jalen Duren game tonight, because it seemed like he was just the usage guy on every possession to start the game. It didn't end up really being that because of what Malachi Flynn did. But going into this game, Cade Cunningham's a late scratch. That throws things just through a cycle immediately when you're about to play. Really, it should be one of those games where Jaden Ivey cooks. Like, perfect situation for him to do that. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. Like, 3 for 15 from the field, 1 for 4 from three, like you said. Definitely made some defensive mistakes as well. And it wasn't just him. I don't mean to pick on him. Duren made some mistakes defensively as well. And the starting group just didn't look good as a whole. Thankfully, what Malachi Flynn did and the rest of the bench came in and brought some different mojo in and brought things closer, kept things close. But yeah, it just was definitely a bummer of a night from those two, when this is a perfect game where you really want to see things out of them, especially when you're playing a team like Atlanta, who you can score points on.
You know, what I think has been, I guess, interesting to follow this season is that regardless of the context, right? So that being Cade healthy or not, who's out there with him, if he's with the starters, if he's with the bench unit, it seems like Jaden Ivey is more or less playing the exact same role every night. That's not necessarily a bad thing. And you know, he did shoot 15 shots against the Hawks. Like, that's not nothing. He did get plenty of volume in that
game.
The
most of anyone besides Flynn.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, like, he got the volume. He didn't capitalize on it. And I guess what's been most odd to me, I can't think of a better word. I'm tired, guys. I'm sorry. But most odd to me is the types of plays he's getting. He's not getting a ton of, you know, like DHO stuff. He's not doing a lot of ISO stuff, which you'd think you would want your other top five pick guard to do when Cade Cunningham, for example, goes out, right? Either to the bench or misses a game. He's not really doing that. I mean, it seems like most of those touches end up going to, you know, against the Hawks, it was Duren. Sasser got a lot of it. And obviously Malachi Flynn, once he started rolling. But I can't remember a game outside of that Brooklyn game where Ivy went off for, I think he went over 40 that night, that he has gotten that type of, you know, increased volume in that way, rather than just getting more attempts in this kind of narrow silo that they use him in at the moment. Are you seeing the same thing?
Yeah, in general, he just hasn't been able to get it going most nights. And he hasn't, like, Cade Cunningham has been a guy where the start of his career, sometimes we still see it, he's slow to get going, and then the second half turns on and he's cooking. Ivy, I haven't really seen that from him much. It seems like he needs to get into a rhythm early. And like you said, he's getting the same sort of look, so maybe it is using him in a different way, but he's not getting that opportunity. So how are you going to get him going if he's just doing the same things? He is, I mean, I'm not in his head, obviously, but he is probably lacking confidence. What do you need to do to get a guy like that going? Because it seems like everything they are doing, he's just not able to find it when he gets out to a slow start.
So you'll find this interesting. These are all from NBA.com, which is kind of compiling synergy stats. But this is for just Jaden Ivey. All right. So Jaden Ivey, 24% of his play types, which is just 24% of the types of plays that he's participating in when he's out on the court, 24%. Is as a pick and roll ball handler, 24% is as a spot up shooter. So roughly half of his volume right now is in those two silos. He is in the 49th percentile as a pick and roll ball handler and the 8th percentile in spot up shooting. Now, you kind of compare that to isolation and dribble handoffs, where he is in the 73rd percentile and 60th percentile, respectively. So far better, far more efficient, right, guys? Only 7% of his plays are isolation. Only 6 are DHOs, which are dribble handoffs. It's kind of proof of concept for something that you and I have brought up a few times kind of intuitively, that the things Jaden Ivey is good at are the things he's doing the least. And deciphering why that is has really become challenging. And I think it's a pretty big question that this team needs to answer going into the offseason.
Yeah, exactly. He's just not, and those stats prove it, he's not getting the opportunity to put him in the right position to score. And that's likely the context of the team. Like, it's playing with Cade Cunningham, who is getting those opportunities. And not saying you should take them away from him, but when Monty brought Ivy off the bench to start the year, I don't think he should have done this, but maybe, I mean, it's tough to say, because now in these games, you're playing him next to Marcus Sasser. So in theory, he should be able to isolate, to run off DHOs, but he's not. And it's not like Sasser can play off the ball. So I guess I don't really get it. But the answer is probably what you've alluded to, is that's just what Ivy's role is in Monty Williams' system. And we're not seeing if that's ever going to change.
Yeah. And I think part of that is, if you kind of look at Evan Fournier, when he plays, the minutes that he gets, he tends to see a lot of the same types of plays, which is, you know, again, something we've mentioned before, but bears repeating it in this context, where, you know, maybe that is just what this offensive system wants out of its two guard. It's still odd to me that, you know, that being said, yes, most nights that's what you want out of your starting two. But when your main guy goes down for a night, surprisingly, that Ivy's not the fall guy, you know, the guy that kind of breaks in all those extra looks. In this case, it went to Malachi Flynn, and rightly so. He went off. And again, flowers to Malachi Flynn. That was incredible to watch. I had a great time with very low expectations going into the game. But in the past, you know, it's gone to Sasser. It's gone to Duren. And I don't quite know what to make of that. It's concerning. That's all I've got. I don't know why exactly, but it is concerning.
What's super concerning is, like you said, and we brought up already, this is the night for him to do new stuff. And to start the game, Duren was the one getting all the usage, all the touches, high volume early. It doesn't make sense why there wasn't that opportunity for Jaden Ivey tonight, but the answer is probably it's a system thing. Like, that's what they see him as on this roster moving forward. And they want him to get better at that role. Now is the time to do it. But to be good in that role, you need to be able to shoot the ball. And that's not what he's doing right now. So you hope to see him string it together from the field, but we just haven't recently, which is difficult and makes it a really confusing situation as we get into the end of the season here.
All right, last thing before questions. I have to bring it up because it bothered me so much while watching this game. Jalen Duren's little ISO free throw line pull-up shot. Can we just burn that? Like, just light it on fire and never do that again. It's same thing with him taking a fast break coast to coast and trying to throw a lob pass to Tosin Awoma. Oh, okay. Let's just burn that with fire. Get rid of it. Am I wrong? That was terrible. Terrible, terrible process. I don't care that one of the shots went in. That was awful.
Yeah, that lob to Tosin definitely made me cringe. I mean, I get the idea, but where he threw it, like, who is going to get that? And
why is Jalen Duren throwing lobs? Catch lobs. Why are you throwing lobs? Catch them.
Yeah, I guess just to give him a bit of a break. It seemed on that possession specifically, it seemed like he got the ball and transition and didn't really have anyone to go to right away. So that's, yeah, I mean, he shouldn't have drove the whole way and made the play that he did, but that's...
Hang on. I'm not letting this go, Blake. If you're a five and you get the ball in transition and you're staring down a 2-on-3, you don't have numbers. I am sorry. Stop and get the ball to a guard. Don't continue on. Stop.
You're right. I feel like we're a little harsh on Duren sometimes, so I'm just trying to give him a break. But you're right. Also, the jumper. I mean, ideally, we've been talking about it, to have a five-man who can at least make mid-range shots, can ideally space the floor out even further, would be great. That's not a part of his game right now. We don't know if it ever will be. I guess now is the time to try it. It's tough when it's like the games don't matter, but it would have been nice to get this win and some possessions like that. Not saying they were the only ones by any means, but you look back to them and say it could have swung things a different way, or it would have stopped an Atlanta run when they were just shooting the brakes off to start the second half. But yeah, definitely want some better decision making and feel for the game there.
Well, and okay, so I'll be honest. I was kind of playing it up, but it did really bother me. And look, I think throw away the context, right? I don't necessarily think the context is important. Yes, if he doesn't do those three things, maybe they're in a different situation. But whatever, they've won, 13 games this year? Like, it really doesn't matter. What matters more to me is the process here. Like, both of those free throw line jumpers were fairly early in the shot clock. Both of them he ISO'd at the top of the key to get into it. Like, okay, Jalen Duren, you want to ISO and get your, you know, you want to get your buckets, right? Fine. Well, you're 6'10". You can jump out of the gym and you're massive. Get to the rim. Don't settle for a free throw line jumper when you're not a shooter. Like, and I mean, okay, so the pass was just terrible process as well, but we've talked about before that he doesn't have the best vision as a playmaker right now. So I guess that's more decision-making than anything else. But just on those jump shots, like, it reminds me a little bit of when he was in summer league and we were seeing him do some of these things, right? He was getting a lot of isolation possessions. He was shooting a bunch of threes. He was taking a lot of mid-range shots. And it's just the pathway for Jalen Duren to become a really great NBA player doing those things is so narrow that I'm not even sure it's worth pursuing. He could be a fantastic lob threat big. He could be a fantastic short roll passer. If he could become a good defender on top of those things, you have a really special five, a guy that's going to be worth a lot of money. So why are we just so obsessed with trying to make him Bam Adebayo for no reason when he's not shown it before? Like, the process just bothers me so much when he does have so much potential to excel in these other ways that he's already pretty good at. He could be elite at all of them. And this is where some of the reps go. And that just bothers me so much.
Yeah. I'm just thinking for reasons why right now, but I think we know he needs to be able to either defend, protect the rim, or shoot a little bit, be able to space the floor. Ideally both. He's probably not that player, but maybe that's why he's working on the shot a little more. I don't know. It's definitely concerning how the possessions ended up. Definitely want to see a bit better processing there. And not, I mean, he didn't have he just had two turnovers, but want to see things that just don't lead to quick transition opportunities for the other team.
Well, and I'll just say this last thing too, right? You know, you bring up the jump shot. I don't think Jalen Duren has to become a shooter for this whole thing to work. If you're going to definitely start Asar Thompson next season, okay, then yeah, Jalen Duren probably has to become a shooter. But you don't have to do that. You could bring Asar Thompson off the bench, and I would understand plenty of reasons to do so. And in that case, Jalen Duren doesn't need a jump shot. So, yeah, like it's something else. We'll just leave it there. Let's get into some questions. This has been a roller coaster for the first 26 minutes here.
Before the episode,
we've gone from the high all the way down to this now. Go ahead.
Yeah, before that, I just wanted to shout you out, Wes. You mentioned you retired. I meant to do it at the top of the show, but we were talking about Malachi Flynn. Wes got up early to record the pin down, the Pistons Pulse with Bryce Simon and Omari Sankofa at like 7:30 a.m. I was still making my coffee. Yep. And now he's up after the Pistons Hawks game, which started at 7:30. We started recording at 10. So just wanted to shout out to you. No offense to anyone, but we got the hardest working man in Pistons podcasting with us right now.
No. Don't give me that label. Take that one back. I just really like talking about Pistons basketball, though. More and more, I'm wishing they gave us more good stuff to talk about.
Dedication.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun. We get this platform, right? Someone gave us a mic. Bryce said it this morning. Someone just gave us a mic, and we get to talk about the Pistons for a while. And it's just fun. It ain't work. We're just having a good time out here, Blake. Yeah.
In my case, it was Best Buy who gave me the mic. So
it was Best Buy?
Yeah.
I think mine was just blue. I think I got it from their website. We should get paid for that. Let's get the sponsorship deals going. We got to talk to Sean. All right. First one here. This is from @BasePistons on Twitter. It says, what is the bare minimum that this organization could do this offseason to regain your trust? Loaded question because it implies that they lost our trust already. So first, I would say, address that. Has the organization lost your trust fully or not? And based on that, how could they win it back?
I wouldn't say fully lost my trust because I think that's a big statement. I mean, they might have, but I'm just not ready to say that, I guess. I think for what they need to do, and I'm not really going to talk about coaching or front office changes because I'd just all be speculating. But I guess what I'm thinking is rooted in the front office. They need to use this cap room that they've created effectively to improve this roster. The moves they made last summer, while not talking about what they did in the draft, the players they brought in, they really just, it was a zero. It was a net negative. Nothing good happened. They had all this cap space. They didn't do anything, like they didn't take on a very long-term deal or anything like that. So they're in this position where they have all this cap space again. So I think it's using that, whether it's through trade, whether through free agency, however it happens, to make this team better. I think there have been so many learnings this year on what works and what doesn't. A lot of it, what we're learning right now, is what doesn't. But you know that now. Last season, you didn't have your franchise player for 72 games of the year. You had him for the great majority of games this year. You know what you need to do to improve the team around him, the type of players that he needs to play with, and that will raise your floor overall. So you have the opportunity to bring that in. So it's just a matter of doing it. Hopefully they have the chance to. It's not like they can just go out and wave a magic wand and do it, but they need to find a way to make the roster better.
So let me ask you this then, you know, for them as an organization to give you, let's just say, excitement going into next season, is it purely an outcomes thing where you need to see certain types of players being added to the roster? Or is there something maybe with a little bit more, I guess, nuance where it's, you know, you're looking for some sort of cumulative approach to the entire organization as well? Like, what is it exactly for you that might kind of indicate positive steps forwards?
I think it's some sort of change. I think another thing that they've learned, and this was probably implied with everything I just said, is their starting five doesn't work together. So it's bringing someone in, or I don't know if it's like Simone Fontecchio or Quentin Grimes. Like, I don't think they're going to solve all your issues by any means, but bringing someone in who will address the problems that that group has together defensively, or spacing the floor, bringing additional shooting. If it's one or the other, ideally both, but like long 3-and-D wings are hard to come by. Like every team in the league is trying to find those guys. That's why they get paid the amount that they do. So I don't think it's going to be easy, but I think it's just a matter of, if you're not able to get the perfect player, at least get someone who addresses one thing that you know is an issue here.
Yeah, I think that all makes sense. And that's kind of where my head went as well when I was reading the question. Yeah, I think for me, like the one thing, the one big overarching thing that they could do to like make me very excited that there's going to be multiple positive steps forwards next season would be over the offseason, if they build out the roster with a cohesive vision. You know, I would say you're looking at this roster right now, it seems pretty clear that if there's not directly a difference between what Troy Weaver envisions and what Monty Williams envisions, there's at least a disconnect there. And it's become very obvious out on the floor that the guys that they have right now on the roster just don't quite fit what Monty Williams wants to do. And I mean, look, some people aren't going to like this, but as long as Monty Williams is the coach, then all that really matters is how he wants to use guys. So what they could do this offseason, if Monty Williams is going to remain the coach, build out this roster in a way that fits what Monty Williams wants to do. And, you know, I have no idea what the ceiling of that kind of roster would be. I have no idea what the exact moves would be. Obviously not, right? Like, that's too hard to predict. But if you can do that, I do think there would be significant improvement. And I do think that they would have the potential, if they do that around Cade Cunningham, to push for a play-in or a playoff spot. Like, those are in the cards. They have to do it, though, and that's going to be some tough decisions.
Yeah, get Monty his duo, Michael Bridges and Cam Johnson, or one or the other back. I know we talked about Bridges a bit last week, not saying one or both of those guys would solve all the issues, but hey, a couple players that we know fit well into his system and address needs that this team has. I don't know if they're gettable by any means, but make the call.
All right, this next one here, this is from Derek Brown in the chat here. He says, this is just a statement, but I'm going to spin it into a question. It says, Cade, Asar, Stewart, and Fontecchio are the only players that he wants back on this roster next season. Do you agree with this? Would you add anyone? Would you remove anyone? Who are the players that, above all else, you want to see on this roster next year?
So I think this is fair. I think the interesting point is, so obviously Jaden Ivey and Jalen Duren aren't in this group. I don't know, like maybe you do move on from both of them. Maybe there's a deal on the table where they would net you back something complimentary, like a Michael Bridges. I don't know. The other thing is, and this one is really interesting, is we haven't seen much of any of Quentin Grimes. He was brought in at the deadline. We've seen like 6 games of him as he's fighting through injuries. We know he's a good defender. The shot, he's been a good shooter in the past. He struggled this year. He struggled the little bit that we've seen of him in Detroit. I don't know if like I would want to give up on him that fast, or if the front office does. I mean, I don't know anything by any means, but I mean, they gave up Bojan Bogdanovic and Alec Burks to bring him in. Those are guys you could have parted with anyway. but I think he might be another one. I think if you're looking at to say these are the guys that are untouchable in a trade, we want them back on our roster. I don't even know if the list is this long, honestly. It might be Cade and Asar, but that's putting sort of the question or statement that Derek has here into a bit of a different context. Like, this is really about guys that we think will improve or be positives on the team next year. I think this is a great list here. I think of the other three names I mentioned, at least one, maybe two, will probably be on the roster next year, but it's definitely a good debate and discussion on whether they should be.
Okay, let me throw you a curveball here, because this is what I was thinking, so I want to ask it to you before I answer it myself. But is the answer you would give to this question, like you personally, different than what you anticipate the Pistons front office's answer would be to this question? And if so, like, what's the difference?
So are we saying, like, guys that they want to play in basketball games next year, not guys that they would make? Okay. See, the thing for me is I really don't know, and I would just be speculating again on how they view Jaden Ivey and Jalen Duren. Like, the front office might think differently than any of either of those players than Monty Williams does. I mean, I think I know that Isaiah Stewart is valued in the organization. I know they went and made a deal and brought in Simone Fontecchio so they could keep him for the long haul, or not necessarily the long haul, but at least into next season and probably beyond. So I would say yes, but I feel like they might also want probably Jalen Duren back next year. But I'm not confident in either of those. Interested to hear what you think.
Yeah, for me, they would be different. I think the organization, and again, this is pure speculation, I know absolutely nothing, but just based on, you know, what we're seeing in games, I would guess that the organization would very much want Cade, Asar, Duren, Fontecchio and Stewart back at all costs. Me personally, it would just be Cade, Ivy, and Fontecchio. I would be, and like if we're talking just like, you know, guys that are legitimately untouchable, it's only Cade Cunningham. Like the list starts and ends right there. I'm still very bullish on Jaden Ivey. I still think he's going to be a really good player. And I do fully believe that if they moved on from him this offseason, which it seems like it's in the cards, right? It does seem like it's in the cards. If they do that, I would definitely expect him to go off and be really good somewhere else. The thing is, like, if this is going to be the usage that he gets, if this is the role that he's going to play, he's probably not going to be that great here. So, I mean, that's kind of a bummer, but... Right. Yeah, I'll just leave it there at that one. So let's go to this. This is from Rames. I thought this was a pretty good question here. Rames in the DBB comments. He says that seeing how Cade Cunningham is a top 25 scorer in the NBA right now, is it more important to surround him with quality role players, or would he still really benefit from adding another 20 plus points per game score?
I think you still need another guy who can score the ball alongside Cade for a couple of reasons. Like, if for some reason there's a night where he's not going, you need someone else to go to get your offense going. And also just all the good top teams in the league have a secondary scorer next to their star, or they have multiple stars or three stars, whatever it might be. I just think to be successful in the league, you need guys who can score the basketball. That sounds like a obvious statement to make, but it's true. And ideally, it's someone who can shoot the ball as well. I think not only Cade, but the rest of the group would benefit from having someone else to go to, because the offense, we've seen it stall at times when Cade isn't really cooking and or slow to get going, whatever it might be. So it's big for the rest of the group too. Obviously, we know after this long season, it's important to surround him with quality role players that complement his game and the rest of the players on the court. But I think it's pretty much necessary to have another guy who can at least get close to 20 points a game.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, in the NBA nowadays, like you need guys. You could probably bump this number up to 23 or more points per game as a guy to target and add. Like they need, if not a go-to guy, at least a secondary scorer for, like you said, if Cade is off, then it's super valuable. But even with Cade, when Cade is on, I mean, we saw this season him put up over 40 points and the team still lose. And it's because no one else stepped up to the plate and took it the rest of the way. Like, you just need multiple guys that could go for 30 on any given night. And ideally, they go for 30 together pretty frequently, right? So I would say that has to be a priority, especially if you don't think Jaden Ivey can be that guy next season. It has to be a priority. The role players really need to improve as well. I think the tricky part about this question, though, is that in an ideal world, that other 20 points per game scorer would be a forward. You know, it'd be someone out on the wing who's big, physical, can handle the ball, and can shoot. And, well, everybody wants those guys. And rookies that fit that mold usually aren't scoring more than 20 points per game in their rookie season. So how do you find that guy next season? Does it just have to be a guard? Like, it's kind of a tough spot.
Yeah, and I actually want to compare this to a relevant women's basketball thing here. Like, Monday, we saw Caitlin Clark drop 41 points, take down LSU to go to the Final Four. She had a teammate that dropped 21 points and another that dropped 18. When you have a player like that, a star player that you know is going to get theirs, defenses are either going to scheme and double them, whatever they want to do, or let them get theirs and say, okay, the rest of you go and beat me now. And that, I mean, debatable on what happened in that game, but I think it's a total different game if the supporting cast isn't there. So I think it's a similar thing that recently happened that really proves that when you have a superstar, star, whatever you want to call Cade, you at least need some sort of scoring around him that could go up for 20, 25, 30, whatever it is on any given night.
All right. Well, I mean, how about the guy that a lot of people still like to compare Cade Cunningham to? That's Luka Doncic. I mean, Luka Doncic, he's running a heliocentric offense. You know, he's the main guy. He's taking all the shots. All this is true. But for the majority of his career, he's also had Kristaps Porzingis, who's a very good scorer. And now he's got Kyrie, who's, I believe, scoring over 25 points per game. Like even the guy that I don't think Cade Cunningham's Luka Doncic, but if you do, even Luka needs someone else that can go get buckets. And he's always needed someone else that can go get buckets. And he hasn't even won a championship yet with this setup. But to get as far as he's gotten, which is a heck of a lot farther than the Pistons have gotten since 2008, you need guys that can get buckets. So, yeah, I think the honest answer is both. They would really benefit from both quality role players and adding another very good scorer. But, yeah, man, adding that other scorer is big time. This next question is here from Jonathan Schwartz. Says, honest question, and we appreciate the honesty, man. He says, is it likely that Jaden Ivey and Jalen Duren will have lower trade value than they will have, than their trade value this offseason? So he's saying that right now, the trade value of those two guys, Jaden Ivey, Jalen Duren, is kind of deflated at the moment. Do you agree with that? Do you think it could go lower? Do you think it could go higher? What do you think the trade value of those two guys is right now?
I'm leaning toward that it can go lower just because of the point they're at in their careers. And Jalen Duren, super young at Jaden Ivey. I think he just turned 21, if he's even 21 yet. So I think it can go lower just because teams are going to want to take a shot on one or both of them. And I, on the Pistons Pulse this morning, Bryce brought up, like, he's almost interested to see Jaden Ivey get traded because he wants to know, like, what his value is around the league. I think that's something that we don't know. And yeah, it's interesting. I personally think that he has a decent amount of value. I mean, I don't really know what he can get you back. I think it's at least like a good player and maybe a draft pick if a team really wants him. Depends who the player is, obviously. But I think it can go lower. Are you in the same boat, or what do you think?
Well, real quickly, he is 22. Jaden Ivey's 22.
Okay.
Look, Jaden Ivey, I personally think his trade value is still extraordinarily high. I mean, through all the struggles that he's having this season in efficiency and, you know, just Monty Williams, right, to put it bluntly, he's still averaging 15 points, 3 rebounds, 4 assists. Like, yeah, he's not shooting it well from 3, but he's getting to the free throw line a lot. He's a fairly good passer and flashes a lot of playmaking talent, and he's an incredible athlete who finishes around the rim at a pretty good clip on a lot of attempts. Like, the raw pieces are all still there, and truthfully, it's not necessarily that Ivy has regressed this year so much as he's stagnated from his rookie year, which you are able to explain away a little bit just with the presence of Cade Cunningham coming back and Ivy shifting to a little bit more of an off-the-ball role. Point being, if you're a team that maybe doesn't need a point guard per se, but needs someone that can really break down defenses, really get to the rim in isolation possessions, and kind of playmake out of that, especially in the half court, you would really value a 22-year-old guard with 2 years left on his rookie-scale contract like Jaden Ivey, who, oh, by the way, has averaged over 15 points per game in the first 2 seasons of his career and was a former top 5 pick. Like, that guy, that's one of those kind of rare second draft guys where they've had a lot of success, but they haven't perfectly meshed anyway with the context that they're in. So, I mean, long story short, I think Jaden Ivey would have quite a bit of trade value. And I think Jalen Duren, as much as I have defensive concerns about him, I mean, he is so young. I don't think it would be too difficult for another team to look at him and go, you know, hey, we can fix him, right? I mean, James Wiseman, for all that he was in Golden State, which is not a lot, got Sadiq Bey, who you mentioned scored 50 points for the Pistons. Like, you could probably get something pretty good for Jalen Duren too. So, you know, I really don't think that either of those guys' value right now is all that low. I mean, is Jaden Ivey's value lower than it was when the Pistons picked him and it seemed like every other team was calling to see if they could get him? Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. How much lower? Maybe not all that much.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I still think they're pretty big trade pieces if they're ever going to be in that conversation. And like we've mentioned, I mean, really since the start of the year, if you do move on from Ivy, you know he's going to be one of those guys that can probably go off in a different situation and one of those that might leave a little sour taste in your mouth. So it might be that he needs a new situation, so that brings his value a bit lower. But yeah, I'm leaning toward the value can go down from here because I think it's still high.
All right, how about this, Blake? Would Jaden Ivey be the number one pick in this year's draft if he was coming out right now?
Whew, that's a tough one. I've heard people say that, but I'm going to say no, just for the sake of conversation. I think he would go high. I'm just going to say he wouldn't go one, just because I think there is an interesting big man prospect that you have there. And Alex Saar, there's also some wingy type players that we mentioned. Every team in the league needs. Everyone is trying to get them, and they're hard to come by. So I'm going to say no. I mean, I think he'd definitely go two or three or really high, but I'm going to just say that he wouldn't go number one.
We're on the same page. I would take Saar over him. I think, you know, the archetype that Alexander Saar is kind of in that Evan Mobley mold. Now, Evan Mobley was a much more complete prospect coming into the league than Saar is right now, so you do have to downgrade it a little bit there. But that type of player is still so valuable to NBA rosters right now. A big guy that is athletic, he can move, he can shoot, and he can block shots. Like, that guy changes your scheme on both ends in terms of just what you practically can do and how creative you can get. So everybody's looking for that, right? I mean, everybody wants Evan Mobley. Everybody wants Jaren Jackson Jr., Chet Holmgren, Wembanyama, even though he's like to the nth degree of this type of player, right? Like these are the guys that everyone's trying to grab right now. So I do think Saar would still go number one. That said, I would definitely draft Jaden Ivey over Reese Hoshea, who I have number two on my board right now. I mean, especially, you know, if we just erase his 2 years in Detroit and he's just coming out of Purdue right now, right? We don't know anything. That the profile that Ivy was, I mean, I was all over it. I think he was a fantastic prospect. Still do, for the record. But so I'd take him too.
Would you draft Jaden Ivey over Reed Sheppard?
Oh, yeah. No question. I just said I'd take him too, Blake.
Okay.
I just said I'd take him too.
Hey, I know you're a big Reed fan. You know, so I love Reed. Yeah. I wanted to see.
No, yes. And it's a good question because now, right, where the Pistons are, preview for draft time, but I'm going to be talking a lot about fit. I can tell you that right now. And Reed Sheppard as a prospect is probably a better fit than Jaden Ivey as a prospect, but I would definitely take the upside swing there with Jaden Ivey. But hey, speaking of the draft, this one is from KCP for three, and it's through in the DBB comments. He just says, in general, would adding another young player through the draft do anything to help this roster, or should the Pistons try to move the pick?
Yeah, I'm going to add a bit more context that he added in the DBB comments that we just couldn't fit in the banner here. So wanted to call it out. KCP for three and it's through also mentioned that he's been very underwhelmed by the draft prospects, specifically Saar and Reese Hoshea, and even mentioning that the college guys have been a bit lackluster, not the most exciting prospects. So I think it's a valid conversation. I think they should definitely consider moving the draft pick. As we've brought up a bunch of times, we don't know if they'll be able to. We don't know if there are other teams that are going to be interested, because even though, like, Wes and I both have Saar number one on our boards, but I'm sure there are, like, this draft is as open as any. We don't know with whoever wins the lottery where they're going to go. And because of that, other teams, especially if they have a pick in the top five, top 10, they might just stand pat, stay and see if their guy falls for them. But I think on the other side, bringing another young player in is a valid point. Like, Wes, you've brought up in the past, we don't need any more young guys. We have our hands full. We're trying to develop them as much as possible, and we need like vets or at least a little more proven guys that complement the roster, that can help maximize it. So I think that's fair to say. That's definitely what you're doing by keeping the roster the same and adding another young player that you're prioritizing through the draft. The flip side of that is, do you know if all your young pieces are still going to be on the roster next year? I mean, I think ideally at least one of them is moved in some sort of deal. So you're not putting all your eggs in the young upside basket, but who knows if that's going to happen.
All right. My answer to this is going to spin into a question that I want to ask you at the end of it, which is kind of related to what you just wrapped up with right there. But, you know, look, with all of these, hey, the draft really stinks this year, we need to trade the pick ideas. Guys, like, it takes two teams to make a trade. Okay. So if the draft stinks, then no one wants your pick. Like, if you don't want your pick, no one's going to want your pick, right? It doesn't matter if, you know, a guy, you know, a team at five really has their eyes locked on, you know, maybe Risache, because Risache very well could fall to five. Like, we just don't know how this is all going to shake out. And even if a team does love Risache, maybe they have Cody Williams right there behind him and they don't view it as that far of a drop off. I mean, without full access to the boards, we don't really have a full understanding of, you know, how the valuation for a trade would go, how much more value each team would want to receive or send out in the deal. And just generally, if the pick that the Pistons have is bad enough where, you know, us fans, we really want to move it, then, you know, I just think it's very smart to continually remind ourselves, hey, like, the other team would have to want it, right? You can't just wave the magic wand and move back and like get a really good young player in the process. You might move back four spots for a second round pick or something. Is that worth it? I don't know. Like, probably not. So I say all this to lead into this question. We just talked about Jalen Duren and Jaden Ivey's trade value. Is it possible that either of those guys or both of those two combined would have significantly enough higher trade value than this pick would, even if it lands at number one? And I ask this because I think I agree with KCP for Three's assumption here, just the original assertion that adding more young players isn't necessarily the best path forwards. So you have two ways to get that number down. You could trade the pick, or you could trade some guys currently on the roster. And if the guys on the roster have more value in a trade, maybe that's a better path. Though maybe not. I'm really curious to hear what you think.
Yeah, the interesting thing to me is I'm not sure. One, I think it would be very risky for Troy Weaver to trade a top five pick. It obviously depends what the deal is. So, yeah, I'm not just holding him in that category. I think it's a risky thing for any GM to do. And especially in this draft, I mean, this is the case every year, but there are a lot of upside swings. Like, you mentioned Cody Williams. We haven't seen a ton from him at Colorado. We've seen flashes, but teams are drafting him because of his upside and what they think he can be. So say the Pistons fall at number three in the lottery. They trade that pick. Cody Williams is that pick, and he turns into his brother, Jalen Williams, or whatever, like, not making that easy comparison, but I think that's a very tough thing for a GM to just take on the chin. And I don't think that this organization specifically should be willing to do that, especially after how these past two seasons have gone.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. I really do. I mean, I'm very sympathetic to that as well. And, you know, I think just to build on what you said there, I really like you pointing out that, yeah, there are going to be probably one or two stars that come out of this draft. But even more than that, there are going to be a few guys that carve out, you know, like 8-year, 10-year careers as a starter too. And I mean, that would be really valuable even just to add to this roster, a really high level starter. So, I mean, yeah, it's not the strongest class in the world. There's no Zion Williamson. There's no Wembanyama. But I mean, you're still going to find guys. There's still going to be impactful players in here. So, you know, I guess it's kind of up to your scouting chops as a GM and with your staff, which I don't know. Let's ask this question from Coffee here, which is related to that. Based on Troy Weaver's past performance as a GM, would you have more confidence in Troy Weaver, the draft picker or the trade maker? Maybe that has something to do with, you know, what this answer will be, whether they should trade the pick or trade one of the young guys.
That's a very good point. Personally, I think I have more confidence in drafting. We've known that that's what Troy is known for, his talent eye and things like that. And I think while he has had some misses in the draft, the glaring one being Killian Hayes, we have seen more misses in the trade market. So this one's pretty easy to me. I think there's more confidence if the front office is the same. I think they would feel better making a draft pick than taking a big swing on a trade, which we really haven't seen them do yet.
Yeah, I think I agree. The only thing that would make me, I guess, maybe pause before confidently saying that, yeah, I definitely would rather see him make a pick rather than make a trade, is just that, you know, I guess we don't really know the organizational context that he's operating in. It's possible that not all of these decisions are purely Troy Weaver. I mean, of course, it's in fact very likely that not all of these decisions are exclusively made by Troy Weaver. There are obviously a lot of voices, and there are in every NBA front office. But, you know, James Edwards III put out a great mailbag article this morning, and you guys should go read it. It was really good, answered a lot of very good questions. And there's a part in it where he's alludes to maybe there being significant other cooks in the kitchen. I'll just put it that way. And if that's the case, and there have been significant voices influencing the construction of this roster, maybe there have been mandates on how the roster should be constructed. Maybe Weaver's wanted to do things that he hasn't been able to do yet. I mean, like, these are all big if, ands, or buts, right? Obviously, we don't know. It's pure speculation. But without knowing that, like, without knowing for sure that everything that's happened is 100% on Troy Weaver as the GM, I guess there should be a little bit of leeway, in my opinion, where, you know, maybe if you remove the, you know, the bumpers along the alleyway, that it would have looked different. I don't know, though. And my gut feeling is exactly what you said. I mean, the draft has far better track record for Troy Weaver than does trades.
Yeah. And in James Edwards' article, he also mentioned that he's heard rumblings or wouldn't be surprised if the team brought in like a president of basketball operations above Troy to be the final decision maker. And obviously, it gives us a little bit of an insight into some of the issues that might be going on. I mean, we don't know for sure by any means, but maybe right now there isn't really that, hey, this is what it's going to be person that is the final stamp of approval. So maybe doing that, and you could do it different ways, like just make things less siloed and have clear responsibilities. I'm using like corporate talk right now, but like just having something clear, I feel like might help as well, like James pointed out in his mailbag article today.
Yeah, just real quick, guys, to be clear, to make sure we're not like aggregating the article or anything egregiously, right? He also mentioned things about potential changes with the coaching staff. He mentioned that what you said about Troy Weaver potentially having someone hired above him, that wasn't like a solid report or anything.
Right.
You guys really go read that article. It was a great mailbag article. Lots of good nuggets in there. Lots to pull from. But we're going to wrap it up. The Malachi Flynn game. That's what that's going to go down in history as, Blake. Let's just come full circle. The Malachi Flynn game. What a fun game, even though they lost. That was incredible. I got to give it to him.
Yes, April 3rd, 2024, mark it down in the history books. Shout out to Malachi Flynn. Shout out to Wes for getting up early to do the Pistons Bowl, staying on late to do the pin down. We appreciate you, my man. Go get some sleep. Everyone, thank you for joining us live. Please like and subscribe at Detroit Bad Boys. We're going to get better at saying that. Leave a review on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to our podcast. It really helps us bring this thing further and do some more cool stuff. So thank you, everyone, for joining. And special thanks to Sean Corp, our managing editor over at Detroit Bad Boys, for supporting the show. Shout out to you guys for the great questions and talking points that you gave us tonight. We'll catch you next week, whether on your commute or live with us here on YouTube or Twitter. We can't wait to talk more Detroit basketball with you.